In Kohor, he is the black goat. In Yiti, the lion of night. In Westeros, the stranger. All men must bow to him in the end, no matter if they worship the Seven, or the Lord of Light, the Moon Mother, or the Drowned God, or the Great Shepherd. All mankind belongs to him. Else somewhere in the world would be a folk who live forever. Do you know of any folk who live forever? Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Originally founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we decided to rebrand when the game relaunched in the second edition. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and world we love, and of course to my co-hosts and you, the listeners. Please, if you enjoy the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your platform of choice. Comment on our Facebook threads, or even better, support us on Patreon. We love turning that kind of support back into the community. This is Season 10 of the White Book Podcast.
The real question, Will, is who wants to live forever?
That is a good question. Most people. Until they, get pretty old. And then that opinion often changes. You know what? This is getting really depressing. Let's move on.
Well, I will give brownie points to anyone who catches what the question "who wants to live forever" is a reference to. Is it relatively obscure? Al, is it relatively obscure? The song "Who Wants to Live Forever"? Oh, I just spoiled it. It's relatively obscure.
It's not like crazy
obscure. It's pretty obscure. But anyway, so no brownie points because I ruined it. But anyway, it's a good song. Not really, but it's also a good song.
Did you watch the Queen biopic recently?
I have not seen the movie. No, it's I've heard so many mixed things about it that I've just been like, you know what? This is a cultural moment other people can have.
Interesting. I've heard basically nothing but good stuff, even out of some pretty rabid fans that I'm friends or acquaintances with.
Yeah, I don't know. I've just heard. I've heard so many different hot takes that I'm not interested in it, because like my upcoming hot take movie I'm gonna go see comes out this Friday, or I guess would be have been the Friday after this episode comes out, or maybe which is the new Harry Potter movie,
Fantastic Beasts. Yeah, that comes out the Friday before this one comes out. This episode,
okay, because that comes out the 16th, right? So
yes, yeah.
So this Friday we're gonna go see that movie, and. That's my controversial pop culture movie of the moment that I'm going to go see. So, Queen fans can have Freddy. I'm gonna have whatever the hot mess that movie is going to be, the Fantastic Beasts movie.
I've been seeing some pretty mixed reviews, but whatever. I love the Wizarding World, so if I get to escape into it for 2.5 hours or whatever the runtime is on this, I will be pretty content with that.
I really, really loved the first movie, so I'm interested to see the sequel, even if it's weighed down with a bunch of additional Grindelwald baggage that wasn't necessarily super apparent until the end of the first movie.
Yeah, and maybe oddly done. I don't know. We'll see how it kind of plays out in this movie and the three others that are planned after it, but I feel like from what we know so far that this Grindelwald stuff is playing out substantially different than we were previously led to believe, and I don't know. Maybe that just shows the inaccuracy of wizarding history, but
or rolling, coming back around to something. She's like, "Oh, this is a good idea. I'm going to expand on it, even if it throws her previous timeline out." Although she still hasn't thrown her timeline out quite yet. So,
not completely. I don't know. Maybe some of it is my having read into things from when I read the Harry Potter novels, getting the kind of impression of Dumbledore and Grindelwald kind of being wrapped up in this whole knowledge for its own sake sort of thing, and getting in much deeper than they should have, and Grindelwald kind of continuing down that path when Dumbledore turned back, and I don't know, that's definitely not the impression I get right now from the movies. So
I think that subtext is still semi-present. Like, you don't have to discharge that, right? Because it taking place in the early 20s and then now the late 20s, like, that's 40 some years, because it's supposed to be the late 19th century when the initial Grindelwald stuff goes down. So it's been 40 years. So, you know, now he's delved the depths of dark magic and now wants to have a, you know, a splash and change the world. So you don't have to entirely ditch your interpretation to make it fit where Rowling's gone.
It may just be that the focus of my interest maybe is more in seeing how that descent started rather than already picking up once he's already descended.
Yeah, makes sense. So this has been a great Harry Potter fan cast. Thank you all for joining us.
Don't tempt me. You now make me want to do one. I would sit around and debate that with you for hours.
I don't know. There's a fandom. I wouldn't want to be in the public-facing part of the Harry Potter fandom. My sister did that for a while, and it was heated. It was a heated world.
Oh, I bet. Folks are very, very passionate about that type of thing.
It's true. It's true.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Well, does that count as a whole lot of banter this week introducing episode 358?
We'll see how much we'll see if Will moves this to the end of the episode. So I'm Roy
and I'm Will, and it's just the two of us this week. I think it will be a succinct cast aside from our early digressions.
Indeed. So Will, do you have a giveaway for us?
I do have a giveaway. There's still a couple magnets left. I promise next giveaway, though, I am going to rotate back around to something different for a couple weeks. But one of our brand new patrons, actually won a magnet this time around. Thank you, Jason T, for supporting us.
So, thank you, Jason.
Yeah. Also,
people like you who make this show possible.
Exactly. It really is. Hosting and such would add up very, very quickly. So yeah. Also, do want to throw out a thanks to Sam M for supporting us on Patreon. We picked up two new ones this month, which was nice to offset. We've kind of been bleeding folks for the last 6 months or so. So thank you for those that do support us.
Thank you very much. And I hope you enjoy your magnet. And I hope you're still enjoying the White Book.
Indeed. Okay, so giveaway taken care of. Other than that, we've got a topic this week that was Roy's brainchild. I may co-opt it with some questions I was crafting earlier today, but what's your vision here, Roy?
So I thought it would be interesting to sort of talk about the cohort agenda. It's been about 2 or 3 months now since Florian's agenda sort of like stamp, ran over us and sort of was the new hotness. And it's, you know, one of the things that's definitely the case since I've been reviewing Card now on the show for 2.5 years, I guess, something like that, is that, you know, it's easy to miss on Cards. We miss all the time. But I think it's also really difficult to really get a good sense when you're reviewing how agendas are going to shake out. And I thought it would be really good to come back and sort of revisit what Cohort is, what Cohort does, where its place in the broader meta is, and sort of what kind of deck styles it promotes, and ways to play around Cohort if you find yourself being dominated by your either in a tournament or your friend just really, really loves goats.
You know, that last statement is really loaded. Really loaded. I'm gonna stay
going for it.
Far away.
It's just the two of us. We gotta keep people interested.
Yeah. Otherwise this episode runs the risk of being rather dry compared to some of our co-hosts. Oh man. Well, okay. So I know you definitely had mentioned here before the episode that you wanted to take a look at some specific things, but I had a few things I was looking at earlier today in kind of a more broad theoretical sense that I wondered if I could slip in before we dial down further here. So
sure.
I was spending some time kind of poking around on the annals to take a look at some of the stats here for Cohort. And okay, so it gets a little wonky to try to do because Cohort can be run with the Alliance agenda since it's a banner,
yes,
which complicates things. But I'm pretty certain that, you know, 99% of the Alliance builds that we've seen pop up in the last few months since its release are probably Cohort. So
I have not seen a deck that's Alliance without a Cohort agenda since it was released.
Yeah.
I mean, that's purely anecdotal, but I definitely agree with you there.
Yeah, I have not seen any either. It really cut out a lot of the maybe not cut out a lot of the incentive to do some of that weird stuff, but gave you much better incentive in other directions, shall we say.
Yes.
But I was looking around at that since release, and then just since like Daznax Pit on up to kind of get a feel for things. And one super broad thing is I think there is maybe an argument to be made that Cohort is the perfect agenda. When you take a look at some of these different stats here, like if you look at it from its release in March on Winterfell to now, it's running at about a negative 0.03
it's pretty good.
Yeah. Sorry for qualification ratio. If you average that out, or since Daznak's Pit, it's at about a 0.2 positive. So it's almost zero. Like it's running about 4% of participants, about 4% cut, and about 4% win. I mean, all of those vary a little bit here, depending on exactly what you're looking at, but it's never more than a percent one way or the other. Mm-hmm. There's like 23 agendas right now, if I counted correctly.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, so the percentage is relatively close if you were to just straight divvy that between all the agendas. And it looks... Granted, we don't have a really long time period here, but it looks really consistently at like exactly where you think any given agenda should be in a perfect world. I found it fascinating that, you know, the thought that maybe this is the perfect balanced agenda.
I think it might be because while it's very powerful, it makes you put a bunch of garbage cards in your deck to function properly. And when I say garbage cards, I mean that like cards that if you were just running a regular 60-61 card deck, you would never run a lot of these attachments simply because attachments just tend to clog up your hand. They are terrible top decks. They are, most of the time, they're usually not that great on setup. They're just sort of like really clunky cards. Even like powerful, we have a ton of really nominally powerful attachments in the game, but they're really difficult to play in traditional 60 card decks. But of course, Kohor lets you play with a lot of those cards, forces you, because you need a certain critical mass of it to make it worth running, sure. Particularly with its downside. So that permanently makes it a niche, right? Like, while it is really powerful, the very nature of the pool of cards it's asking you to access wants to do some very narrow sets of things. And that's always going to, in many ways, be self-correcting, unless Danny prints some just truly busted attachment. Like, he's come close.
I was going to say, I wouldn't be surprised.
A little bit about... Well, but I mean, there's one that's currently in the card pool that's pretty close to being busted. But
does it start with a Q?
There are two then, yeah. That one, and it starts with an L as well, and we'll get to it in a minute.
Exciting. You're teasing the listeners.
So there's two, actually. Maybe I was thinking about a different deck, but yes, the Q attachment is good. But I think that that's a really good design. Like Florian, there we go. Corian, which is, I guess... both a Mass Effect character and what happens when you smush together Kohor and Florian. Florian, I think, did.
Let's do it.
You're speaking my language there, Will. That's trading with the Kohor, you know, it's probably the most balanced yet powerful agenda. Like, there's more balanced agendas in the game, like the summer agendas. Those season agendas, summer, winter.
I mean, they're
balanced.
Chronically like underperform and underparticipate. Like, I don't know if that they're truly balanced if they can't show up in like statistically, you know, averaged results. You know.
Well, I think one of the things we've really seen in second edition is that agendas are, the power level is much lower for a lot of agendas. And for them to be better than fealty or a banner, they have to do something really broken. So all of the more balanced agendas, the ones that either have a legitimate downside or a legitimate limitation or a way in which your card pool is somewhat constricted. So we have like summer, winter, brotherhood, to a lesser extent, faith militant. They tend to be really not that strong overall, because the opportunity cost of not running the banner, not getting access to the most broken card, broken 12 cards of another faction, or the economy of fealty, you really need something busted. And so the successful agendas, Free Folk, Lord of the Crossing, Wars to Come, reigns for a good long while, they're just really pushed, like really, really pushed. And I think Kohor is the first one that is balanced in the sense that its drawback is legitimate, both in the sense that that one gold can mean something and it forces you to play with, kind of, again, to go back to my shorthand, garbage cards, that it allows you to have a powerful deck, but a powerful deck within a niche that is just balanced out by the fact that all the other players have access to much better tools and much better cards. Generally speaking, a single banner agenda can be overall stronger than Kohor because those 12 cards that you're bringing in are the best 12 banner wolf cards, and have a much broader, usually, sort of pitch than the attachments do.
Okay. I mean, I can see something here. I do also find it interesting that a couple of those agendas at that top end that you listed off there are champ agendas, you know? So I think there's maybe something to be said for them being purposefully pushed as opposed to something like the Kings of Summer and Kings of Winter agendas.
But Lord of the Crossing was designed by Nate and Free Folk was designed by Danny. Like, I mean, they're both capable of pushing. And so was Brotherhood. Brotherhood was also designed. Well, no, not Brotherhood. I'm sorry. Free Folk, Lord of the Crossing. Why am I missing one?
Reigns.
Yeah, those are the only two. Right. No, Reigns was designed by Alvaro, right? So, yeah. So Danny and Nate each designed one busted second edition. Jedi,
so I guess that's good. I don't know. They split it up a little bit.
And Sea of Blood, which we'll be seeing soon, feels pretty busted. Of course, like I said earlier in the show, it's hard to fully see how good an agenda is going to be until we really have sleeved it up. But I have a sense that Sea of Blood is going to be really good. And that's definitely all
stuff. Danny. Definitely kind of takes on a life of its own once it's out in the wild. like you mentioned with some of our initial impressions and reviews, sometimes that can be very different once the whole pool of players gets to hammering away at things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I mean, that was my main broad thought here is just kind of wondering about the pluses and minuses. I think overall it's a great designed agenda here, and barring some big missteps with the attachment card type going forward, I think it looks like it will probably remain in a really like strong but not overbearing position. But I don't know. We can't predict the future real well, and folks would have said a while back that Reigns was likely to stay on top, and look what happened to that.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely true. I think Reigns suffers because. That's interesting. We could probably do a separate episode. I'd love to have like Aaron on to talk about like why Reigns suffers. But I think faction card needles is a much more scarce resource than it was when it first came out. I think more factions have access to green icons. And I just think that Reigns was on top for so long. I mean, it came out in what? The first year of the game? So we're on year number three, so it's been out for about 2 years. That it set the baseline, and then all future champ agendas and Danny and Nate's own agendas had to be designed at par with it, and so to see any play. And so then you reach a point where it's just going to get power creeped out because they're going to once the point that they have to push an agenda up to its level, they're just going to, by the nature of card garden design being an art rather than a science, they're going to push things over Reigns of Castamere eventually. And then they did that with Wars to Come, Kohor, and probably Sea of Blood now. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, we'll see with that future one, but I think I definitely agree with your premise that you can notice a shift in agenda design to kind of push up to that level after Reigns was released. Some maybe didn't quite come together, like say Conclave, but the effects definitely got bigger. You can't say the scope of the Conclave effect isn't big. It at least, you know, flashy, impressive, whatever. It doesn't seem to have panned out in play. But it was much, much bigger than, say, banners or fealty type stuff.
Yeah, right. I think so it's interesting actually to talk about the Conclave versus Kohor, because I think what's interesting, what makes the Conclave weaker than Kohor is, even though they both in many ways have similar drawbacks, that they make you play with shitty cards in order to get some kind of like busted interaction, is that Kohor doesn't demand that you win a challenge with a character with an attachment on them to get access to it, right? Instead, it's saying, like, you can just do your faction, and if you're running the Alliance version, your faction plus another 12 cards from 12 plus cards from another faction, you just do the standard busted, you know, whatever the best thing in your faction is, and then you also get this effect on top of it by winning challenges. To get and then to be able to tutor things and move things around, all that kind of stuff. And we can get to the play in a minute with the play patterns with it. But the Conclave adds an extra level to that. It's not just that you have to play with these 12 maesters of maybe there's like six really playable, well, two really playable maesters that you can run six copies of. You have to all then win a challenge with them in order to get the busted effect of this, you know, deciding what your draw is going to be.
I mean, and whether it's busted or not is kind of debatable anyway. I mean, they've got some maesters that sort of replicate something similar to Kohor, right? The ones where they reveal your top card, and then if it's an attachment, put it in your hand, and or, you know, some different things to manipulate that, and try to help with your card selection, I guess. But they're all gosh, very narrow in their focus here. Kohor just says, go grab something out of your entire deck.
That's true.
I mean, sure, you have to sacrifice a card to do it, but there's no additional like gold investment ongoing after that, you know, to play the new attachment you got or anything. Conclave, you gotta invest in whatever you found a way to get. It's just, it feels like it's about three extra moving pieces to do what Kohor does with just the challenge win.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, the card selection and the fact that it's, what, seven random cards off the top of your deck. But also, like, yeah, running a 53-card deck. I mean, I played a lot of Stark Conclave for a while. Like, running that 53-card deck is pretty good. And being able to swap the the best card in there onto the top of your deck when you need it, if you could win a challenge, there's the drawback, is very powerful. But it's just the maesters are so bad.
yeah.
Like, yeah, they're just bad, and they're cheap. And, you know, I haven't come back to Conclave in a while, since First Snow is much more out of the meta than it was when I was playing Conclave. But, like, it just makes me sad that it's not as good. But, you know, Danny's going to really have to push the maester trait for it to be good in a way that he doesn't really have to push attachments for Kohor to be good, because that tutoring effect and the ease in which you can trigger it. In fact, he needs to be careful about what he does. Yeah. Like, I think for Conclave to ever be the point where it's going to be a maximum Jamie level agenda, or even really a successful Shaga / Melisandre level thing, like, he's really going to have to push maesters. But he doesn't have to do that with Kohor. Kohor restricts design space in some ways, while Conclave is still opening up design space if he wants to go there.
And we will see if he does. It kind of worries me, since it's been quite a while now without it getting follow-up pieces, but I don't know. We'll see where it goes.
Yeah, it's been a while since we've gotten a maester.
It's not like they aren't still doing things at this point of, like, where we would be in the novels. It's not like we wouldn't have seen Old Town by now or anything.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, like, the Sam chapter of Feast for Crows has, like, more maesters than any other part of the books, and we haven't really gotten any of those maesters really show up. I think only a couple have been, like, one of the Tyrell ones, I think, showed up. But that's basically it.
Yeah. I mean, and I'm dying for, like, we haven't gotten a second Ed Marwyn or something.
Marwyn, Sorella, right? Well, what's Sorella's secret?
Alaris.
Alaris? Yeah. Yeah. Then the one that gets killed, Pate. There's, like, a lot of, like, different... There's a lot of, like, maester design space, like, in the character pool from Martin, if Danny chooses to go there. And I am surprised he hasn't really.
I feel like there's a lot of untapped iconic stuff that we've kind of breezed by as we've gone.
Yeah, we still don't have a Tormund. Mm-hmm. But we didn't have a Tormund in first edition, did we?
Oh, did we not? Maybe we didn't.
I don't think we did, so maybe just FFG doesn't like Tormund.
That's so sad. Such a great, amusing character. We also don't have a
we're sort of
we don't have Vargo Hoat either. Gosh, thinking of
we don't have
very iconic stuff. Plus, where was he from? He wasn't from Westeros, right? Wasn't he a mercenary from somewhere else?
He's from Kotor, I think, actually.
Funny how we can just bring that right back around.
Vargo Hoat. He is... Yeah, he's from Kotor.
There we go.
So, the Google worked. All right. But I think maybe we could jump into talking a little bit about sort of the play patterns maybe that it promotes. So I think that there are sort of two ways that you can break down Kotor decks the way they exist right now. There's sort of like tempo Kotor decks, and which are generally mid-range strategies, and then there's the combo Voltron. And I'll start with the sort of more straightforward one because I think that that's a good place to start. And for a while was the most common, but now you see much more of the combo Voltron. But so, like the tempo decks, which were popularized by Wama, James Wamsley, congratulations again from Worlds, James, who sort of burst on the scene with that at the end of regional season when the goat when goat came out with that Stark Kotor deck, and then also here in the United States, Bryn Alcorn won. The Philadelphia Regional, which was the biggest regional in North America, with it as well, and this was a pure tempo deck. So what it was doing was it was using the attachment package in Stark, so in the neutral control attachments like Milk of the Poppy and Seized by the Guard, but also like some of the Stark attachments like a couple of the Dire Wolves. And King and the
Wolf King.
What's the Stark King attached? The Wolf King, using those to create big tempo swings that you could win a minor challenge, and your whole board could suddenly be controlled. Right, the ability to turn Lady into a Milk of the Poppy, the ability to turn Lady into a Seized by the Guard that's shutting down your best location can just create big tempo swings. Particularly early on, it gives you a lot of spot control for big problems of how your opponent is going to interact with you. Like, because again, like the goal, as I explained in a recent video I did for the White Book YouTube channel, like mid-range decks live or die by their tempo and their ability to maintain a tempo advantage. And what GOAT lets you do, because tempo decks, mid-range decks like Stark, really, they just want to win challenges. That's their primary way to win the game. They are rewarded for doing what they already were good at, which was winning challenges, not by a lot. The great thing about Kotor is you don't have to win by 5 or win by 12 or whatever, or 4 if we're in first edition. You just win the challenge. So it can easily win at least one challenge, sacrifice one of its attachments, and completely mess with its opponent's tempo and its ability to answer what you're doing is just like a really powerful effect. And this sort of, it really just pushed up mid-range strategies at a time when they were much less popular, when you had Mace running around, comboing people down, Drowned God starting to combo people down, and, you know, Night's Watch stealing your stuff because a new wall came out roughly the same time as Kotor did. So it's just a really powerful way to say no to the fun things your opponent's trying to do to answer your strategies.
You know, something I found really interesting when taking a look at this is particularly taking a look at, say, Wama's build here, like right about that time period, which is way back at 4 months ago now, feels like forever in Thrones terms. That really seems to have been the last gasp almost of something that leans into a more tempo to tempo control sort of direction with Kotor. In looking through popular or and tournament winning results since then, there really hasn't been anything on that front. which I find very interesting, particularly because these were out of Stark, which, you know, like you said, has some very strong in-house options with things like Frozen Solid to get a lot of value there. But this also would have been just prior to the release of never mind, sorry. Wyman is in this deck. I looked right past him. No, this must have been just after.
It was pre cohort. Not cohort, pre Skagos, excuse me. Obviously not pre-cohort, we're talking about cohort deck yet. Pre-Skagos. Like Skagos has its own warping effect on the kind of things that Stark wants to do. Particularly with the restricted list suppressing a little bit some of the power of Stark Rush. So the fact that it now has access to this really powerful sacrifice effect really just pushes Stark, even Stark midrange, in a different direction, right? Like, because you can literally compare Wama's Stark goat list to the one that he was in the top four at Worlds with. On an overall strategy level, they're actually very similar decks. Like, they're mid-range decks. They want to control the challenge phase. They want to screw with your opponent's tempo. But Kohor gives a different set of tools for that, and Skagos gives you a set of tools. And just, like, the fact that Skagos is backed up with passive power gain and the ability to answer your opponent's attachments and all kinds of just really interesting tempo plays that you can make with it, that I think is overall that just that one card more powerful in some ways than what Kohor does, which is why I think people have moved away from Stark Kohor.
I think there is one other aspect of Skagos versus Kohor that's worth pointing out, which is that there are less ways for your opponent to interfere with Skagos going off. If you've got one of, at this point, numerous Stark cards you want to use that with, and Skagos, like, your opponent has to have effectively their own Frozen Solid or Seized by the Guard or what have you to answer that Skagos. They must have their own specific card-based answer for that. Otherwise, you just sit there and do what you want to do with no interaction necessary from them. Versus Kohor being intrinsically tied to a challenge, your opponent always has that point to push back on you. They always have an option where any, you know, characters or whatever they have in play can attempt to minimize your game plan. So I don't blame people for moving to Skagos that is less able to be interfered with. It just makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I think it's also because natively the card Skagos just synergizes so much more with just the overall Stark card pool. I mean, Wyman, you mentioned earlier, but also you've got the 7-cost cat, you have Rob, you have now Mira. These are all like cards that are just asking you to find sacrifice outlets, and the just tight synergy between all those cards really just overpowers the power of trading with the Kohor. And I think, honest to goodness, if Skagos itself disappeared, people who are interested in tempo strategies out of Stark will go back to Kohor. But Skagos provides such an efficient engine to power those effects that the Kohor package isn't really worth it.
Okay, if I might sidestep a little bit, we've been really homed in on Stark, and I do agree that this type of build was kind of the last big shot at something that wasn't a pretty Voltron-y type build that we'll get to in a minute. But if I could even sidestep a little bit further back, and this is maybe still going back to some of our initial impressions being a little bit off, I am a little curious about, you know, when Kohor was first kind of about to be released and first hit our shores, or so to speak, there was a lot of buzz about maybe being able to pull something together with Martell that leaned a little harder in the control event. I think probably still in a tempo area when you're using things like Locked Away, which is, you know, basically a pure tempo card, bouncing in Venomous Blades, that sort of thing, and or maybe trading the icon removal attachments for different icons, depending on exactly what opens up a weakness on your opponent's side the worst or whatever. And if that deck ever really came together, it's further back in the annals, so to speak, than I want to dig right now. Do you think there's any particular weakness that dissuaded that deck from coming together?
I mean, this is where we really need Glazer, because he's much more of a Martell theory person and Martell practice person than I would. But I think the way the Martell card pool shakes out, you can see this in Leonard's winning strategies, right? So much of it is about the traditional control game plan of successful. Well, there's two different Martell builds, right? There's the Martell Wars, which doesn't want the cohort package because it's like needs its enablers, sure, right? And that's a proactive deck. But the reactive decks, like, they give up so much early tempo that the cohort package isn't really attractive because you're losing so many challenges. You'd rather just use Dorn or other tools to regain that tempo versus cohort, which I think is really better. To go back to quadrant theory, it's really best at breaking through at parity, because it's really hard for decks to stop you from winning at least one challenge, even when you're in a like tight board state. Like, they can push, you can push through like an injury challenge or a military challenge. Really, if at the end of the day that challenge in the grand scheme of things isn't going to win you the game, get you through, like, you can't push that big renown challenge through, but if you kneel the right people, you might be able to win a military challenge, or you might be able to win an intrigue challenge, even though the board's at parity. That's where cohort, I think, really shines, because you can then completely wreck your opponent's tempo just by winning one single challenge by any amount of strength. I think the Martell decks, those lists are so tight because they have to just have so many tools to regain their lost tempo, that a powerful switch when you are so far behind is just not worth it to them. They'd rather, make rooms for Dorns and Water Gardens and Secret Schemes and all these other kind of tools that they have, that going for the attachment package is just not worth
it. One thing that I really, really like there was the nod back to quadrant theory and parity, and thinking about any card like, say, cohort, that lets you search out one specific answer in your whole deck. I mean, like, you look at that list of Wamas, how many 1x attachments are there here for specific situations? There's quite a few. And any card that lets you go nab one of those is great at breaking parity in your favor, because so often you just need that one answer in your deck to upset the balance, rather than something where you're already ahead and just trying to close as fast as you can, or something along those lines, or even behind where you frequently need more than one answer. So this kind of search is definitely best at parity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Parity or ahead, yeah. Like, you can just close a game for you. But I do think, it really shines, and you really see the power of the tempo strategy for cohort at parity, where you're like, wow, if I can put a seized by the, a seized by the guard on their wall here, or their Dorn here, I just open up the whole game for me, is just really strong. So, I think we could probably move on to probably the more well-known archetype, but I think there's one card that we're missing here that we haven't discussed yet, which is one of the cards that powers this whole archetype.
Yes.
It's, of course, Isle of Ravens, right? All cohort decks run Isle of Ravens because Isle of Ravens allows you to shuffle one card into your discard from your discard pile into your deck, and that just, of course, lets you go infinite. Since I'm not doing a video, you can't see. I just did scare quotes around that. Go infinite with cohort, and is extremely important if you're playing against a cohort deck. Targeting their Isle of Ravens is a very powerful play. If you can lock it down, they're in trouble. You can. Because they'll eventually run out of their good attachments, and then you can start just overcoming the advantages that they gained in a longer game.
Indeed.
Jumping into the Combo Voltron thing, this did come in a very rough version of it. Came roughly the same time as Wama's deck, which was Nico's Lannister Stag Alliance deck. That won a big regional in Italy and sort of took the world by storm. And, you know, Nico then played a bunch of Alliance cohort decks for the rest of the regional season in Italy. He had a Tyrell one that was really strong. He had a Danny one that was really strong. Just these Voltron / combo decks that are based around, battleshipping up a big character and using them to run over your opponent. He used Disputed Claim in his Lannister one, his Lannister Stag one. He used Queensguard in his Tyrell one to sort of get multiple challenges out of somebody like Renly. And then, of course, the Danny one just uses a bunch of the Danny attachments plus Queen's Guard, plus just the fact that Danny herself is a Voltron character supported by a bunch of good attachments on her, is really strong, because what this deck can do is play that tempo game, proactively using cohort. And then once it sees its Voltron / battleship character, it then plays that combo game where it just uses cohort to just keep the chain going, keeping the power game going, keeping the card draw going, keeping the challenge train going in a way that just becomes so overpowering for your opponent that they just really don't have room for it, room to do anything.
Let's see. Trying to think here a little bit back to some of the stuff that I was taking a look at. Like, because there's obviously several viable houses or builds for this more kind of proactive, constructive battleship or Voltron sort of thing. And I was kind of curious taking a look at that. You can see those numbers kind of shift to these sort of houses, where suddenly now Tyrell is by far the most powerful and potent of those from a number perspective, and I think that's not surprising given the number of positive attachments they have to boost their people. They've got protection with Blessed by the Maiden, that sort of thing. You wind up seeing like Stark following up close behind that, and Targ as well, which I found interesting. I'm wondering if that's still a little bit of holdover from some of the more tempo-y sort of thing, but I don't know. Regardless, the rest of that thought that I'm distracting myself with is what is really the best combination here to go with from a Voltron perspective? I mean, do we go all the way to the brand new, in quotes here, Night's Watch stuff with John? Is it better to main house Tyrell? There's almost too many options right now. What factors would you use to decide the strongest option?
I think it depends on the meta. I think in raw combo potential, Targ is the best. Because of its ability to go close to infinite with Silver Steed and power challenges. If you've ever been on the receiving end of that interaction,
there's a melee deck for
it's
you.
It's really unpleasant. And it's a strong and melee. Dark Naj had a melee version that he was going to play at Gen Con, but we were in the cut and tired. It's just a very strong, powerful effect, and it can go off in Joust, which, like, as Nico showed, I think Nico played Steedy Wonders. This is another regional that he won with this, right? So, you know, he's done that as well. So I think if you're going for a pure combo, like, you want to win very quickly in a single turn once you've assembled your Voltron, Targ's the way to go. Queen, and it gets the first of the two broken attachments, gets to be in your deck if you do that. It's going to be Queen's Guard, because Queen's Guard's ability to let you just constantly be standing, not needing any of the dragons to do a lot of the things that Danny wants to do, just constantly be putting her into challenges, both on attack and defense. Just, and then you can, once you are sort of used up your Queen's Crown, you can change it out for something that you need, is really strong. Not that you often have to change out Queen's Guard, because you've usually won the game when you have nowhere use for it. So I think if you're interested in the pure, like, combo Shaga / Melisandre flash,
the highest ceiling, you might say.
The highest ceiling. But the deck with the lowest floor, or highest floor. Is the Night's Watch deck. I actually think, to go back to it, I think that the Tyrell and the Targ are the best alliance builds for Kohor, if you want to go the Voltron route.
Interesting.
But the Night's Watch one is best mono. You don't need the other faction cards.
No love, you know, for the wider redundancy that Tyrell Mainhouse offers you?
I love Tyrell Mainhouse, and, you know, putting Queen's Guard on the new mace and drawing a bunch of cards is really cool. But I think that John is a busted card in Voltron, the new John. The fact when he has Intimidate, Insight, and Stealth, and then you have that interaction with Seal of the Hand and Spare Boot, where you stand John with Seal of the Hand, attempt to move it to Spare Boot, so it stands, but it never moves to Spare Boot because he's not a legal target. So that lets you get two uses out of Seal of the Hand. Ooh. It's just so strong. And yes, if you run the Tyrell package alongside it, you can get things like the courtiers to stand John and do all the other stuff, but that's like gravy. Like, two to three uses out of that John, particularly if you're running like Satin, is just all you really need to dominate a challenge phase. And your opponent ends up in this, like, do or die, which is like, if they make you first, you're going to intimidate down their best characters and draw cards and stealth past them and be switching practice blades in for Milks of the Poppy and all this kind of nonsense. If they go first, they're just defending. They have this John who you can never get past because he has stealth and a bunch of strength and insight. Too. So if you do challenges into him, he's going to win and you're going to draw a card. It creates these really unpleasant situations. And then, of course, it lets you abuse. So if Queen's Guard is the first most broken attachment, the second most broken one is Lord Commander, which lets you claim a power anytime you win a challenge while it's in play. It can only go on 6 cost or higher characters, but conveniently John is 7. And if once you get that on John, it's really difficult for your opponent to interact with you. And the fact that you can turn the catapults into them. So like the catapults let you get, if you don't see John, they give you the ability to control the challenges phase for the first couple of turns. And then once you see John, you sacrifice a catapult after you use it to get Lord Commander, and then you just start running over them. Is just super strong. You don't need any Tyrell cards. You want in that deck to be as streamlined as possible. You don't like adding, I think the mistake that the Red Cloaks made in their build, that they took to Worlds, that great players like Fred Bird and Stephen Ebrey and Matthew Woodard played, was that they were running 75 cards when they didn't need to. I think for the Targ decks and the Tyrell one, you need the 75 cards, you need the Tyrell cards in the case of the Targ, and you definitely need the Targ cards in the case of the Tyrell, but I don't think you need Night's Watch. And that's why I think it makes it the most competitive in the meta as it exists right now, because the deck is really strong against Greyjoy. And that's why they played it. That's why the Red Cloaks played it, was because it just has such a good Greyjoy matchup. Like, such a good Greyjoy matchup. And a very good Rush matchup. So it's probably the most consistently competitive Voltron cohort deck currently existing. But the Nemer / Nico decks can run away with tournaments and do really well. But as Nico showed at Worlds, if you're not practiced and you don't read the meta perfectly, they can also fall flat. But I think that the safest bet is the John decks. That was a long speech, but I hope my point came across.
No, I think so. I mean, and I specifically kind of quizzed you for your thoughts on the strongest build. So all you did was, you know, answer the question I posed, which I'm all for.
Because I can definitely, you know, as the people who have watched the Hound the Wyvern videos go, I can talk about decks for a very long time without stopping anything. So I appreciate that.
Well, are there any other parting thoughts here on cohort? Because really, those two branches are virtually all of us showing up in cohort at the moment. Whether someone's cooking up something tasty, I don't know, but it's all that's public.
The other one is Hanno's Knight's build, which is kind of like a combination of the two. Which I think is called Horny Knights, I think is what he named it and published it. I got run over. It's one of the Dream Crusher decks that I ran into in my fall from 3-0 to 3-3 at Worlds this past year. I know it was not a good moment. Was Evan from the UK and I believe he's Norwegian. But he lives in Scotland. He played a very tight version of a very tight game against me with this deck. And I think it's the closest to being a combination of the two that we've been talking about, because it can definitely play that tempo game of, you know, winning challenges early, controlling your opponent's tempo, putting in the milks of the poppy, putting the seized by the guards, but then can switch into a soft Voltron, you could say. Like, it doesn't really need any of the specific characters, but it can use either the Knight synergy or powerful attachments like King of the Wall to either A, draw a bunch of cards, or B, gain a lot of power really quickly. So it's like a combination of the two. It doesn't really rely on a specific character the way the John or the Danny or the tall Tyrell build does, but it's still got a somewhat similar strategy to them in the sense that it's going to use the attachments to gain as much power as it can pretty quickly. And it can definitely gain power quickly once it gets going. So this would be the other thing to keep an eye on if you're looking at Kohor in the meta. This deck is good. Yeah.
Awesome. You know, one thing I really do find kind of interesting about something like this Horny Knights deck, so to speak, is, you know, Baratheon's really kind of been panned for quite a while here. But you see something like this doing well, and something that really jumps out at me is the King at the Wall attachment and the, I mean, not only the sheer power level of, like, high burst draw out of something like that, but also the way that functions with the old, we haven't talked about this in a long time, but the old false banner concept, where your banner house is actually by card count your main house. Now, this list in particular, I think, is probably a little more balanced on that front, though the locations skew heavily anti-Baratheon. But I mean, they are not Baratheon, which is the main house here. So I find it interesting that arguably one of the most potent Baratheon builds right now is leaning into that false banner direction, which maybe makes it a little harder to count as Baratheon. I don't know. The character base is a more even split.
Well, I mean, yeah. I think it's definitely a case. I mean, Baratheon's most. I mean, Hanno did win. You know, he won. I forget what he won with this. He won regional in Germany with this, and he won Brawl at the Crossroads Inn with Baratheon Summer. But overall, Baratheon's more successful builds for a long time have been with a banner. Like best finishing Baratheon deck was Banner Wolf. There we go. Lots of bees there. and so I do think that just kind of says that, like, there's just not as many good Baratheon cards as there are for other factions. Like, the fact that you just don't really see a lot of successful mono Baratheon decks. We might see more now with, they got some good cards, as you guys noted in the last review, but they're still pretty far away from the rest of the faction. So we'll see how things develop.
Yeah, I'm game to see where we go, and maybe we'll have time to really explore that during the card break here. That, or it'll get stale and people will get bored. We'll see.
Yeah.
Either way. Props and slops.
Sure. This will come out. Will this come out Thanksgiving?
Yeah. This should be out that weekend.
So I want to prop everyone who is planning to attend Red Saturday, which of course is my favorite tournament of the year, the spiritual home of Thrones in the northeast of the United States, and of course is the first annual Northeast championship is being held at Red Saturday this year, which is such a huge thing. It's the end of the NECT season. We'll have some big announcements at Red Saturday this year about NECT 2019, because spoiler alert, we have another season planned. I hope that's not destroying the excitement that people who are planning to attend Red Saturday, knowing that we are going to be announcing another season of the Northeast Championship Tour. But it's been an amazing year for NECT. It's been an amazing year for Thrones of the Northeast. I want to thank all my co-organizers, but particularly Mike Lamzik, for just sort of bringing it this year. But, you know, Than, Murdoch, Vac, Todd, Tom Malucci, I said Than, right? just to make sure. But I want to make sure that I didn't forget him, because that it's very important. To, you know, we've had a good year. We've really just really shown that the Northeast is the best place to play Thrones in the United States, and it's been great. So I want to thank everybody who's coming out to sort of end our first inaugural season of the Northeast Championship Tour in style in New York City.
I think it's going to be a freaking awesome event. So I'm eager to see how everything goes and what some of the special announcements and such are.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Well, I think the prime one that I ought to mention right now is actually definitely on a slop front. That is, of course, the sad news that Stan the Man Lee passed away yesterday. So it's, you know, even when you know it's bound to come, the guy was already 95. It's always a bummer to lose a living legend. So there you have it.
Yeah, I agree that it's sad, but I also think it's one of those things where I'm actually glad that Stan can rest in peace, because if people have been following Stan Lee's life over the last year or so, he's been as he sort of slipped into true old age and lost some of his faculties. He's been taken advantage of a lot, and I think that the fact that he can no longer be taken advantage of and can rest in peace, knowing that he accomplished a lot in his life, I think is a good way that we can remember Stan for his accomplishments rather than the sad turn that his life took towards the end.
I think that is a great outlook on things. Well played, sir.
So, but yes, definitely slop, losses hard. I want to prop the, what did we play last night? The third episode of the Council historical adventure game, which has gotten more insane. It started off very insane and has gotten increasingly more insane. There's still two more episodes, one of which is out, but my fiance and I haven't gotten a chance to play the fourth one yet. But it's very insane, highly historically inaccurate, and very fun. So I would recommend that if you like Telltale style games, if you like the kind of, I don't know, interactive movie style adventure games that were sort of popular a few years ago, before Telltale hit its snags, I would definitely check it out.
Oh man, it's funny you mention that. I mean, would an actually historically accurate game really be very fun? I mean, aside even from the fact that the outcome would be predetermined?
No, I mean, no. Like, the question isn't like, I don't believe historical accuracy in video games is at all important. In fact, I generally actively reject. The more you become committed to the literal interpretation of what happened in the past in your video game, like, for example, the Kingdom Come game that came out this past year, the less interested I am in your game. I think that that's incredibly dumb. Nobody wants to, why you would want to spend your video gaming hours tediously doing a bunch of things that people do in real life is something I still do not understand. And do it in a nominally historically correct way is even dumber to me. But I do appreciate attempts to be thematically historically accurate. And there's actually weirdly an inverse relationship often in games where you see Kingdom Come might be literally historically accurate, but thematically not historically accurate. So, you know, like the fact that Assassin's Creed Origins, which Ala has been playing a lot of, while is highly technically inaccurate, there's so many inaccuracies in the actual things that happened in that. But thematically, it actually does a good job of capturing ancient Greece. That's what matters to me. Does it create the feel of ancient Greece and stick true to what we've learned over time about those civilizations and those time periods? And Assassin's Creed Origins does that. The Council does that sometimes, and then it makes a left turn into pure insanity that is extremely enjoyable as a historian or a former historian.
That sounds intriguing. So, if I had more time to video game, Okay, well, maybe I'll make some time.
It is. It's worth your time.
Well, on a historical note, I'm going to throw out another slop, actually, to historically blue ribbon winning Pabst Beer, who is embroiled in a legal fight with Miller Coors, which could potentially end Pabst as a brand. So we'll see how that goes. It's not always my beer of choice, but I do like it.
I mean, this is where we really need Jesse. Like the
I don't know what you're talking about. Every time he's come to my house, he's brought a 30 pack of Coors. Yeah.
Ugh.
Oh man, no, careful. I can never buy Coors. That's Nate French's beer of choice.
You know, I think Nate's a great designer, but he has a terrible taste in beer.
That is definitely an argument we've had.
That's his favorite
many
beer.
Times. Do you have anything else here, or should I throw my solitary prop out so I don't end everything on a sad note? I'm going to prop a TV show Kristen introduced me to. There's only one season on Netflix, though I've not double-checked to see if a second season is running right now. It's called I'm Sorry. It's on True TV, of all things, which I formerly knew for, like, Cops-style reality TV shows. But evidently, they've gotten into scripted comedies. The best thing I can liken it to is what if you cut all of the fantasy football out of the league, but just left that same kind of humor? That's basically I'm Sorry, which I've gotten a huge kick out of. I really like it. So,
I didn't catch this, but did you guys prop Daredevil season 3 in the last episode?
I don't know if someone did at some point and I'm forgetting, but not last time.
Well, I want to prop it. It was so much better than the second season. You should watch. If you like superheroes, if you want to celebrate Stan Lee's legacy,
cool.
Watch Daredevil season 3. It's really
so
great.
That I can watch season 3.
You just don't. If you've seen Defenders, you don't really need to have watched anything else. You can just jump right in.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then yeah, you should probably watch Defenders.
Watching it out of order would probably put me where?
In the danger zone?
Yeah. Yeah, it would.
This closes another chapter of The White Book. We'll be right back.